a full length ahead of Rosemont. Up in the stands, the Howards and Smith were thinking the same thing. Rosemont is too far behind. Seabiscuit is going to win. Without warning, horse and rider lost focus. Abruptly, inexplicably, Pollard wavered. He lay his whip down on Seabiscuit's shoulder and left it there. Seabiscuit paused. Perhaps he slowed in hopes of finding an opponent to toy with, or maybe he sensed Pollard's hesitation. His composure, which Smith had patiently schooled into him over 6 months, began to unravel. Seabiscuit suddenly took a sharp left turn, veering 10 feet across the track, and back down into the deep going, straightening himself out just before hitting the rail. He had given away several feet of his lead. The cadence of his stride dropped. What had been a seamless union was now only a man and a horse jangling against each other. From between Rosemont's ears, Richard saw Seabiscuit's form disintegrate. He looked toward the wire. It seemed close enough to touch, but Rosemont still wasn't past Seabiscuit's saddlecloth. He had been riding on instinct, reflex, but now his heart caught in his throat. I am too late. Desperate, he flung himself over Rosemont's neck, booting and whipping and screaming, Faster, baby, faster! Striding high in the center of the track, Rosemont was suddenly animated by Richard's raging desire. He dropped his head and dug in. Seabiscuit's lead, stride by stride, slipped away. For a few seconds, at the most critical moment of their careers, Pollard and Seabiscuit faltered. For 15 strides, more than the length of a football field, Pollard remained virtually motionless. Rosemont was some 10 feet to his outside, leaving plenty of room for Pollard to swing Seabiscuit out of the rail path's slow going. But Pollard didn't take the opportunity. From behind his half-moon blinker cups, Seabiscuit could see nothing but an empty track ahead of him, nor is it likely that he could hear Rosemont over the roar from the grandstand. Or perhaps he was waiting for him. His left ear swung around lazily, as if he were paying attention to something in the infield. His stride slowed. His mind seemed scattered. The lead was vanishing. A length. 6 feet. A neck. The wire was rushing at them. The crowd was shrieking. With just a few yards to go, Pollard broke out of his limbo. He burst into frenzied motion. Seabiscuit's ears snapped back and he dived forward. But Rosemont had momentum. The lead shrank to nothing. Rosemont caught Seabiscuit, then took a lead of inches. Seabiscuit was accelerating, his rhythm building, his mind narrowed down to his task at the urgent call of his rider. But Richards was driving harder, scratching and yelling and pleading for Rosemont to run. Seabiscuit cut the advantage away. They drew even again. Rosemont and Seabiscuit flew under the wire together. Up in their box, the Howards leapt up. Charles ran to the turf club bar, calling for champagne for everyone. Voices sang out, and corks popped, and a wild celebration began. Gradually, the revelers went silent. The crowd had stopped cheering. The stewards posted no winner. They were waiting for the photo. The exhausted horses returned to be unsaddled, and the fans sat in agonized anticipation. 2 minutes passed. In the hush, a sibilant sound attended the finished photo as it slid down to the stewards. There was a terrible pause. The numbers blinked up on the board. Rosemont had won. A howl went up from the grandstand. Thousands of spectators were certain that the stewards had it wrong, that Seabiscuit had been robbed. But the photo was unequivocal. Rosemont's long bay muzzle hung there in the picture, just a wink ahead of Seabiscuit's. Dame Fortune, wrote announcer Joe Hernandez, made a mistake and kissed the wrong horse, Rosemont, in the glorious end of the Santa Anita Handicap. Charles and Marcella collected themselves. The length of Rosemont's nose had cost them $70,700. They continued passing out the champagne, brave smiles on their faces. Pollard didn't need to look at the tote board. He knew he had lost from the instant the noses hit the line. Wrung to exhaustion and deathly pale, he slid from Seabiscuit's back. He walked over to Richards, who was being smothered in kisses by his tearful wife. Pollard's face was blank, his voice barely above a whisper. All around him, people regarded him with expressions of cool accusation. "Congratulations, Harry. You rode a swell race," Pollard said. "Thanks," said Richards, his face covered in lipstick and his voice breaking. He had shouted it away, urging Rosemont on. "But it was very close." "Close, yes," said Pollard almost inaudibly. "But you won." Pollard saw Howard hovering nearby, waiting for him. The jockey went to him. "What happened?" Howard asked gently. Ashen and spent, Pollard said that the rail had been slow and that he had been unable to get outside without fouling Rosemont. If he and Rosemont had switched positions, he was sure Seabiscuit would have won. It was a thin excuse. Pollard must have known that to save his professional standing, he would have to offer more than that, say something that would explain how he had allowed Rosemont to come to him without fighting back until the last moment. Already, harsh words were being hung on him, arrogant, inept, overconfident. He could not have mistaken the reproach on the faces of those around him. His reputation was tumbling. But Pollard gave the public nothing to make them reconsider. Perhaps he couldn't. He had a secret to keep, a gamble he had made years earlier and remade with each race. But he could no longer think that its risks affected only himself. Perhaps Pollard didn't see Rosemont coming because of the blindness of his right eye. It is unlikely that he could have heard Rosemont over the din from the crowd. Rosemont's surge, unexpected and sudden, may have eluded Pollard until very late in the race. Pollard did not begin urging Seabiscuit in earnest until Rosemont was alongside him, just forward enough for Pollard to see him with his left eye upon turning his head. One good eye offers little depth perception, so he may not have been able to judge whether Rosemont was far enough to his right to allow Seabiscuit to move outward. If this explanation is correct, then Pollard was trapped. He was publicly accused of inexcusable failure in the most important race of his career, but he could not defend himself. Had he let on that he was blind in one eye, his career would have been over. Like most jockeys in the 1930s, he had nowhere else to go, nothing else to live on, nothing else he loved. For Red Pollard, there was no road back to Edmonton. If his blindness was the cause of the loss, his frustration and guilt must have been consuming. Howard accepted Pollard's explanation without criticism. Neither he nor Smith blamed him. Almost everyone else did. Chapter 9. Gravity. For 6 months, Tom Smith had been holding Seabiscuit in his closed fist. He had inched him up through back alleys and smaller races, bypassing the nationally spotlighted races in favor of slow cultivation and parochial seclusion. It wasn't until the Santa Anita handicap, with the whole world watching, that Smith had opened his hand. The world had been waiting for him. In the winter of 1937, America was in the seventh year of the most catastrophic decade in its history. The economy had come crashing down, and millions upon millions of people had been torn loose from their jobs, their savings, their homes. A nation that drew its audacity from the quintessentially American belief that success is open to anyone willing to work for it was disillusioned by seemingly intractable poverty. The most brash of peoples was seized by despair, fatalism, and fear. The sweeping devastation was giving rise to powerful new social forces. The first was a burgeoning industry of escapism. America was desperate to lose itself in anything that offered affirmation. The nation's corner theaters hosted 85 million people a week for 25-cent viewings of an endless array of cheery musicals and screwball comedies. On the radio, the idealized world of one man's family and the just and reassuring tales of the Lone Ranger were runaway hits. Downtrodden Americans gravitated strongly toward the Horatio Alger protagonist, the lowly bred everyman who rises from anonymity and hopelessness. They looked for him in spectator sports, which were enjoying explosive growth. With the re-legalization of wagering, no sport was growing faster than thoroughbred racing. Necessity spurred technological innovations that offered the public unprecedented access to its heroes. People accustomed to reading comparatively dry rehashes of events were now enthralled by vivid scenes rolling across the new movie-tone newsreels. A public that had grown up with news illustrations and hazy photo layouts was now treated to breathtaking action shots facilitated by vastly improved photographic equipment. These images were now rapidly available thanks to Wire Photo Services, which had debuted in life in the month that Pollard, Howard, and Smith formed their partnership. But it was radio that had the greatest impact. In the 1920s, the cost of a radio had been prohibitive, $120 or more, and all that bought was a box of unassembled parts. In unelectrified rural areas, radios ran on pricey, short-lived batteries. But with the 1930s came the advent of factory-built console, tabletop, and automobile radio sets, available for as little as $5. Thanks to President Roosevelt's Rural Electrification Administration, begun in 1936, electricity came to the quarter of the population that lived on farmlands. Rural families typically made the radio their second electric purchase after the clothes iron. By 1935, when Seabiscuit began racing, two-thirds of the nation's homes had radio. At the pinnacle of his career, that figure had jumped to 90%, plus 8 million sets in cars. Enabling virtually all citizens to experience noteworthy events simultaneously and in entertaining form, radio created a vast common culture in America, arguably the first true mass culture the world had ever seen. Racing, a sport whose sustained dramatic action was ideally suited to narration, became a staple of the airwave. The Santa Anita Handicap, with its giant purse and world-class athletes, competing in what was rapidly becoming the nation's most heavily attended sport, became one of the premier radio events of the year. In February 1937, all of these new social and technological forces were converging. The modern age of celebrity was dawning. The new machine of fame stood waiting. All it needed was the subject himself. At that singular hour, Seabiscuit, the Cinderella horse, flew over the line in the Santa Anita Handicap. Something clicked. Here he was. Immediately, the reporters infested everything. Smith swatted at them. They staked out the barn, constantly asking Smith to pull the horse out of his stall for photo sessions, and even to let them sit on his back, as if he were a carnival pony. They stood by the rail in noisy clumps during morning workouts, snapping pictures and buzzing in Smith's ear. They photographed the Howards everywhere they went, at the betting windows, at dinner, getting in and out of their Buick. One paper ran a large shot of Marcella in the act of blowing her nose. Smith, Pollard, and the Howards were soon intimately familiar with the strange gravity of celebrity. The earth seemed to dip under Seabiscuit's hooffalls, pulling the world in toward him and everyone around him. The paradox of all this attention was that many of the turf riders who covered Seabiscuit knew next to nothing about horses and racing. Paramutual racing was spanking new in California and many other places, so there were few established racing riders. Much of the coverage was left to complete novices on loan from other beats. Because Seabiscuit's popularity was so broad-based, reporters from publications that had nothing whatsoever to do with sports covered him. Many newsmen were completely ignorant of standard training practices. Some were in so far over their heads that they resorted to invention, fabricating preposterous stories or quotations out of thin air. One columnist wrote that Tom Smith fed Seabiscuit 2 quarts of goldenrod beer before each race. "If the horse doesn't get his beer," he wrote, He whinnies and stops to indicate displeasure. Worse, there were more than a few conspiracy theorists in the bunch. Racing had recently emerged from an era of corruption, and though incidents of foul play were now extremely rare, reporters tended to be overly suspicious of horsemen, accepted rumors of wrongdoing with credulity, and adopted a studied cynicism. Pair an intrusive, usually ignorant, and often suspicious press corps with an intensely private trainer, and you have a volatile mix. Smith viewed the press as parasitic. To foil it, he elevated obstruction to an art form. His first line of defense was frowning terseness. Once when asked to describe Seabiscuit at length, he replied, "He's a horse," and walked away. It was typical of Smith to stroll off in silence while reporters were in mid-question. At other times, he would respond to a question by staring straight at a reporter with a blank expression for as long as 3 minutes, saying nothing. "Tom Smith," lamented a reporter, "is by no means a long-distance conversationalist. 10 words in a row for him would constitute a course record." Talking to Smith, remembered one racetracker, was like talking to a post. His stable agent, Sonny Greenberg, compared him to a mummy. The smart ones learned to keep quiet and let Smith initiate a conversation, which he did every once in a while. The dumb ones pecked at him and got nothing but ulcers. Smith also went to great lengths to keep Seabiscuit's training private. To mollify reporters, he would take Seabiscuit out onto the track during the heavily attended morning hours, but only for slow workouts or jogs. In the afternoons, when the reporters were watching the races, he would sneak the horse out for his real workouts on the training track or another track altogether. If anyone happened to be standing around, he'd do his best to keep them from learning anything interesting. Once, when a man wandered up to the rail of the otherwise deserted track and pulled out a stopwatch to time the horse's workout, Smith asked to borrow the watch, held it while the horse galloped, reset it, and handed it back. "How did it go?" asked the man. "Looked all right to me. It seems to be a nice watch," said Smith. "Not the watch," said the man. "Seabiscuit's work. How fast did he go?" "Damned if I know." The secret workouts had 3 purposes. First, they concealed the horse's superb form from track racing secretaries who assigned imposts. Second, through an ingenious method devised by Smith, they helped the horse stay in racing trim. Seabiscuit was more prone to weight gain than any horse Smith had ever handled. Because he believed that the quickest way to ruin a horse was to overwork him, Smith resorted to creative solutions to overcome Seabiscuit's weight problem. On mornings when an afternoon workout was planned, he would set the horse's bridle and saddle out where he could see them, withhold breakfast, skip his normal morning workout, and do everything else that was typical of a race day. Seeing the tack and thinking he was racing that day, Seabiscuit would become keyed up, lose interest in eating, and fret weight off. Smith would then take him out to work in the afternoon, just as if he were racing. The method worked, and Seabiscuit kept his weight down. The final benefit of the secret workouts was sadistic pleasure. Smith took immense satisfaction in making reporters and clockers miserable. The old man had an offbeat sense of humor. He once electrified a park bench with wires and tacks, ran a trigger wire down the shed row, hid himself in a stall, and spent the day shocking the hell out of every weary hot walker who tried to sit down and rest. Once he became a major subject for the press, nothing was more amusing to him than creating situations that left his pursuers confused and frustrated. They gave him limitless opportunity. Seabiscuit was one of the biggest stories in the country, so they just kept coming back for more punishment. For people trying to make a living covering him, Smith was thoroughly maddening. "Turf riders and clockers swear by Tom Smith," moaned a reporter. "And very often, they just swear." The secret workouts worked for Seabiscuit, but because Smith refused to explain himself to the press, they created a serious misapprehension. The rarity of Seabiscuit's public appearances fueled rumors that the horse was unsound, rumors that were reinforced by the horse's choppy gait. Smith did little to correct them. "That horse of yours can't walk," said one spectator as Seabiscuit bumped past. "Runs, though," Smith replied. Though the horse was dollar sound at this stage of his career, reporters given to hyperbole began regularly referring to him as a cripple. The stories were accepted as fact, and soon the word attached to Seabiscuit for good. It was a misconception that would create serious headaches for Smith later. And Smith couldn't fool everyone. Los Angeles Times and San Francisco Chronicle columnist Oscar Otis was one of the few truly knowledgeable turf scribes and dean of the Western Racing Writers. Almost immediately, Otis was on to Smith. Shortly before the Santa Anita Handicap, Otis discovered Smith working Seabiscuit at 3 o'clock in the morning. "Seabiscuit and Greta Garbo can be coupled in the betting from now on," he wrote in the Times. "Both want to be let alone." The reporters and clockers now knew Smith was up to something. Most of them didn't like Smith any better than he liked them, and they resolved to catch him in the act. Smith was determined to thwart them. The battle was joined. Unlike Smith, Howard relished the attention. Celebrity was his natural habitat. He was not content with mere greatness for his horse. For Seabiscuit, he wanted superstardom, in his own age and in history. He understood that this could not be achieved through racing exploits alone. He had to win over the public. After the 1937 Santa Anita Handicap, Howard began a conquest of the popular imagination. His first effort was to maximize his horse's exposure, plotting an exhaustive cross-country racing campaign that was probably unprecedented in scope, adopting a take-all-comers attitude in choosing Seabiscuit's races and opponents, and even running full-page ads celebrating Seabiscuit's wins. Understanding that the press, as the public's proxy, was the most important agent in his campaign, Howard wouldn't leave the reporters alone. He practically lived with them, bounding up the press box stairs before and after races to make himself available for questions and photo ops, dashing down to the press pool when the horse's train pulled into a station. He made sure that every journalist was aware of Seabiscuit's itinerary. He and his wife indulged every photographer and cheerfully fielded calls from reporters at any time, day or night. Howard went to great lengths to manipulate those covering his horse. He read every word written about Seabiscuit and wrote long letters to reporters. He kept all their phone numbers on hand and called them personally to sway their opinions and make each one feel like a privileged insider with a sensational scoop. He used them to put pressure on racing officials and owners he couldn't influence with charm alone. He offered Seabiscuit mementos for newspaper raffles and sent oversized Seabiscuit Christmas cards to scores of reporters. He even presented members of the press with valuable gifts, including Seabiscuit's shoes cast in silver. It became a little unclear who was stalking whom. Even as he sought mastery over the press, Howard was its servant. He understood that his influence was not limitless, and if he made a move that failed to conform to journalistic expectations, the image that he had painstakingly cultivated could be ruined. In the years ahead, there would be critical moments in which his pursuit of image conflicted with his horse's interests. For Howard, they would present some of the most difficult quandaries of his public life. Howard started marketing his horse in earnest on the morning after the 100 grander. He made things easy for the reporters, posing questions out loud to himself, then answering them. "Are we downhearted over getting licked by Rosemont in that 100 grander? He asked. "No." To underscore his point, he sent a gigantic barrel of ice-packed champagne to the press box, complete with a card. "To the good health of the press box," it read. "We tried our best. Seabiscuit." He had promised to send up the champagne only if the horse won, but it was so close, he said. "I thought I'd send it up anyway." The reporters had a grand afternoon sipping bubbly and raising enthusiastic toasts to Seabiscuit. The newsmen may have been drinking to the health of Howard and Seabiscuit, but no one was toasting Pollard. Up until the Santa Anita Handicap, the redhead had been basking in the attention, boasting of his horse's infallibility, and entertaining the reporters with his quick wit. He would later say, quoting Henry Austin Dobson, that, "Fame is a food that dead men eat. I have no stomach for such meat." In truth, he was delighted with his newfound celebrity. The reporters returned his affection. In a discipline in which athletes bored newsmen to death with clichés and blandly politic statements, Pollard was a singularly fresh interview, articulate, irreverent, and self-deprecating. "He'll probably win if I don't fall off," he told him before a major race. "I fall off a lot of horses, though, you know." But no one was ready to overlook Pollard's ride, the biggest story to emerge from the 100-grander. When Pollard returned to the jockey's room following the loss to Rosemont, he confronted the other side of fame. With Richards a few feet away, happily fielding his invitation to the Santa Anita Turf Club Ball, the traditional party held to honor 100-grander winners, Pollard was bombarded with harsh questions. Why hadn't he used the whip late in the race? Had he thought the race was won? He tried to defend his ride, protesting in vain that he had indeed used his whip and that he was stuck on the slow part of the track, but no one seemed to be listening. The next morning, the excoriation continued. On the track, there were whispers that Pollard had been drunk during the race. The papers hyped his seeming lapse of concentration. Grantland Rice, the preeminent sports writer in the country, accused him of gross overconfidence. But it was Oscar Otis whose criticism cut the deepest. Though he praised Pollard's riding early in the race and his courage in handling the defeat, Otis, who knew Pollard as Jack, was unequivocal in his assessment of blame. "Jockey Harry Richards outrode Jack Pollard at the wire. Otherwise, Seabiscuit, streaking along in mid-stretch with a length lead, must surely have won," he wrote in the Los Angeles Times. With riders reversed, Seabiscuit would have won by half a length. Jack Pollard did not go to the whip near the wire until too late. The defeat may be chalked up to Mr. Pollard. The criticism infuriated Smith, who thought that the horse's swerve down into the rail was the real reason for the loss, a factor unremarked in the press. Smith took Pollard aside and assured him that his critics were wrong. Few things could inspire Smith to actually speak at length. Unjust sniping at Pollard was one of them. He startled reporters with several complete sentences. "Pollard deserves at least half the credit for the brilliant showing of Seabiscuit and the Santa Anita handicap. He is the only boy who knows his peculiarities, his idiosyncrasies, who knows how to get the best of him. Criticism of Pollard is unjust. He rode the horse perfectly." It didn't do any good. A pall hung over Barn 38. Ollie the groom was openly miserable. Howard's usual cheer was forced. Smith was even less friendly than usual. Mulling over the loss to Rosemont, he took out Seabiscuit's blinkers and a pocket knife and cut small holes in the back of each eye cup, giving the horse two rear-view windows. No horse was going to sneak up on him again. Only Seabiscuit was buoyant. He came out of the race full of fight. Pollard took him out for a spin 2 days after the race, and the horse pulled so hard that the jockey returned with angry blisters on his hands. Seabiscuit was screaming to run, and the $10,000 San Juan Capistrano, the stakes finale of the Santa Anita winter meeting, was the perfect spot. On March 6, 1937, Pollard and Seabiscuit walked onto the course for the race. Smith and the Howards looked out over the crowd and saw for the first time how famous Seabiscuit had become. 45,000 rowdy fans had packed the track to see him run, and they had made him the heavy favorite. Though Rosemont had passed on the race in favor of a journey east, it was still a formidable field. Indian Broom was the world record holder at the San Juan Capistrano distance of a mile and an eighth. Special Agent, who, like Indian Broom, was owned by the ACT Stock Farm, was the track record holder at a mile and a sixteenth. The ACT riders were in cahoots to beat Seabiscuit. Special Agent's rider planned to slip away to an insurmountable lead early in the race, while George Wolfe, on Indian Broom, would lay behind Seabiscuit, hoping that Pollard's colt would wear himself out chasing Special Agent and leave him free to pounce on him late, as Rosemont had. Pollard was in a tricky spot. Hot pursuit would be Seabiscuit's downfall, but holding back might hand the race to Special Agent. Pollard wrapped the reins in loops around his fingers and waited in the gate. At the break, Special Agent bolted out ahead of him, while Wolf dropped Indian Broom behind. Pollard could feel that the pace Special Agent was setting was too fast, so he held Seabiscuit right behind him, just close enough to keep him from stealing away but just far enough behind to keep Seabiscuit's speed in reserve. Special Agents Ryder hustled him furiously. Pollard tracked him like a tiger. Rounding into the bend for home, Pollard let a loop of the reins slip through his fingers. Seabiscuit ate up the length of rein, bounding past Special Agent and leaving Wolf and Indian Broom flat-footed. The race caller yelled, "Here comes Seabiscuit!" And a joyful shout rose over the track. Seabiscuit buried the field. With Pollard standing on his back, pulling him in, he flew down the lane to win by 7 lengths, smashing the track record. Cheering swept down in waves from the stands. A spontaneous call was echoing over the sea of heads. "Bring on Rosemont!" Rosemont had returned east. Smith wanted to go get him, but Howard wasn't ready yet. He was working out a glory tour in his head, and he wanted his hometown of San Francisco to see his horse once more. Rosemont could wait. They returned north to Tanforan. Smith was getting wound up. He had tucked Seabiscuit into a steel-doored stall and cordoned off the barn area, but the reporters were driving him to distraction, and he was worried about the weight assignments his horse's success would bring. On April 3rd, he swung Pollard onto Seabiscuit and secured enough lead pads under the saddle to bring the horse's impost to a whopping 130 pounds. As dusk fell, he led the two out onto the emptiness of Tanforan. Smith stood at the finish line as Pollard turned Seabiscuit loose for a 9-furlong workout. Seabiscuit inhaled the track. As he flashed under the wire in the darkness, Smith waved him down. Smith thought he had pulled off the workout in secret. But somewhere, on the oval's apron, a San Francisco Examiner photographer had stepped out of the darkness and snapped the horse's picture. Worse, an owner who happened to be passing by saw the horse working and pulled out his stopwatch. Seabiscuit had worked faster than any horse had raced the entire season. The story was all over the sports pages. Foiled by the press once again, Smith was ready to crank things up another notch. A coincidence gave him a new way to thwart his pursuers. One afternoon in early April, Smith and Howard discovered Grog, Seabiscuit's old stable pal in the Fitzsimmons barn, doddering along in a claiming race at Tanforan. He had changed hands as often as a dollar bill and was now running under the colors of a Hollywood screenwriter. Howard had become fiercely sentimental about all sons of hardtack. "Never sell a hardtack short," he liked to say. He had nearly achieved his goal of buying every single hardtack yearling on the market. He wanted to take Grog in. Smith agreed, and they claimed the horse and moved him in next to Seabiscuit. Within 2 weeks, Smith had Grog and Pollard back in the winner's circle. It is possible that Smith saw something promising in the $4,000 claimer, but the trainer's interest probably had less to do with Grog's speed than with his appearance. Grog and Seabiscuit were practically identical, as they had been as youngsters. Only Smith and his grooms could distinguish one from the other. Grog gave Smith another weapon in his war with the press. One morning, shortly after buying Grog, Smith logged the colt's name on the work tab, then sent Seabiscuit out to work in his place. With no one on the grounds the least bit interested in watching a claimer, the horse proceeded to work 6 furlongs in an unbelievably fast 1:11.25. Someone told the reporters about the workout time, and they were puzzled. With a rocket in his saddle and wings on his sides, Grog couldn't possibly have clocked such a time. But the reporters weren't sure of that, given what Smith had done for Seabiscuit. Someone suggested that the working horse was really Seabiscuit. Smith was, as usual, mum. "If that was Grog the boys took for Seabiscuit the other morning, then let me caution you thus," wrote the turf reporter known as Jolly Roger, who wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. "Look out for Grog." Smith had a field day. On some mornings, he sent Grog out to gallop in Seabiscuit's name at standard morning workout periods, then snuck the real Seabiscuit out to exercise at night. On other days, just to mix things up, he worked Seabiscuit in the morning under his own name. The reporters were immediately and thoroughly confused, and some took to spying on Smith. Jolly Roger, for one, began climbing up to the attic window of the Tracks cookhouse to try to catch Seabiscuit working at night. Smith carried the deception to the stable area. When the newsmen asked him to produce Seabiscuit for photo shoots, he would turn to his new groom, Whitey Allison, so-called because of his unnerving white eye, and ask him to bring the old biscuit out. Whitey would trot out Grog, who was sometimes housed in Seabiscuit's stall to make the ruse more convincing. Hoodwinked onlookers invariably asked to climb on the horse, and Smith, with hospitality that should have aroused suspicion, always agreed. Newsmen, bragging that they had ridden the great Seabiscuit, unwittingly printed images of the lowly Grog in countless magazines and newspapers. Even Howard became one of Smith's victims. One unfortunate artist, whom Howard sent to paint Seabiscuit's portrait, never learned that the horse he immortalized was actually Grog. The stable hands got into the spirit of things. They found that as easy as it was to convince people that Grog was Seabiscuit, it was even easier to convince them that the real Seabiscuit was not Seabiscuit. The horse's bad-legged, cow-pony appearance made fooling people a cinch. Once, while Whitey and exercise rider Keith Stuckey were rubbing Seabiscuit down after a workout, Whitey noticed a man eyeing the horse. The man stepped up, looked the horse over without recognition, and frowned at his knees. "When a horse is broke down like that, what do you do with him?" he asked. "Well," replied Whitey, "we usually sell him to somebody that comes along and wants to buy him." "And what would a horse like this bring?"
"Oh, $500 or $600, said Whitey. "He ought to be worth that."
At the time, Seabiscuit was insured for $100,000, more than any other horse in America. Intrigued at the cheap price, the man walked around to the other side of the horse. He saw the horse's halter plate, engraved with Seabiscuit's name.
"Sure," said the man dismissively, "with Seabiscuit's halter on."
San Francisco was overjoyed to see Seabiscuit again. Responding to banner headlines that read, "Seabiscuit goes today," the largest crowd in the history of Northern California racing packed into Tanfren to witness the Marchbank Handicap, Seabiscuit's rematch with Indian Broom and Special Agent. Pollard was again spectacular. Instructed by Smith to wait behind Special Agent's lead, he quickly saw that the pace setter was blocked and was not going to be able to get to the front. Pollard dove for it himself, took control of the race, then eased Seabiscuit back. Hauling a load of 124 pounds, Seabiscuit clipped past the quarter-mile mark in 22 4/5 seconds, 6 furlongs in a breathtaking 1:10 3/5 seconds, then a mile in 1:36 seconds, each fraction well below the track record for these distances. Then he slowed down dramatically. The crowd gasped. When the field caught him, Seabiscuit bounced away again, winning by 3 lengths under a stranglehold. As the newsman wondered aloud if Man-O-War himself could have beaten Seabiscuit, Howard clattered in. Everyone looked up.
"Say," Howard panted, winded from bounding up the stairs, "who finished second and third?"
Trouble surfaced at Bay Meadows a few weeks later. Seabiscuit was entered in the prestigious Bay Meadows Handicap, but the track handicapper delivered bad news. Seabiscuit received a 127-pound impost. Smith dug his heels in. Knowing that they would soon be off to the east, he didn't want to demonstrate to handicappers that his horse was a terrific weight carrier. But Howard insisted and prevailed. Race day dawned with gale-force winds. With the gusts swirling around him, Pollard arrived at the track. He was in shocking condition. He had been reducing drastically to make weight for another horse and was barely able to stand. Once in the jockey's room, he collapsed. He was unconscious through most of the afternoon. When he was still out cold half an hour before the race, the stewards debated whether or not to call Howard in and get him to choose another rider. A few minutes before post time, Pollard finally rose. He insisted, adamantly, that he was strong enough to ride. The stewards reluctantly let him go. Seabiscuit seemed to sense Pollard's weakness. At the starting gate, he broke through over and over again, delaying the start for 3 minutes. He raced tentatively, and with the winds buffeting him through the home stretch,
won by a modest margin over his stablemate, Exhibit. In the final 16th of a mile, Pollard seemed as if he was about to pass out again, but he hung on for the win. Pollard rode back to the winner's circle and somehow managed to complete the ceremonies. Since the Santa Anita handicap, his riding on Seabiscuit had been impeccable, but he had not gotten past the loss in the 100-grander. The public condemnation was corrosive. The press would not let go of it. At Bay Meadows, his anger boiled over. While walking on the track, Pollard saw Oscar Otis making his way across the parking lot. Otis had praised Pollard in print since his initial condemnation of his ride in the Santa Anita handicap, even suggesting that he may have been wrong in attributing the loss to the jockey. But Pollard's animosity still burned. He turned off the track and into the parking lot, where he stopped Otis and confronted him. They traded angry words. Pollard, surely overwrought from the reducing, lost control. He picked up a newspaper, folded it into a rigid baton, and clubbed Otis once across the face. Otis, a much larger man, dropped to the ground under the tremendous force of Pollard's arm. His face injured, he lay on the pavement, stunned. Pollard turned and walked away. Seabiscuit may have been a public and media darling in the West, but in the prestigious Eastern racing circles, he still wasn't taken seriously. Smith was itching to go east and teach the old guard a thing or two. Howard conceded that now was the time. There wasn't anything left to beat in California anyway. Pollard, too, needed a change of scenery and a chance to redeem himself. A week after the Bay Meadows handicap, Seabiscuit and Pumpkin walked up the ramp of the Pullman car and settled into the straw to sleep. Smith stocked her rear car with all the oats, hay, and straw Seabiscuit would need. He didn't trust Eastern feed. Then climbed in with his horse, unfolding a cot at Seabiscuit's feet. There were giants to slay in the East that summer. Rosemont was there, waiting to meet Seabiscuit in the venerable Brooklyn handicap. So was Aneroid, Rawhide Tough King of the Eastern handicap ranks. And there was someone else, a horse greater than the others. His name was War Admiral. Chapter 10 War Admiral. Samuel Riddle bore a startling resemblance to the illustrated figure on a Monopoly board. He had all the appurtenances, the black hat, the white mustache, heaps of old Eastern money. Everything but the smile. Riddle was a dyspeptic man. In the summer of 1937, he was 75 years old, and his unsmiling face was arguably the most famous in racing. Riddle was the Eastern racing establishment. In 1918, he had plunked down $5,000 at an auction and walked away with the most extraordinary creature the sport had ever seen, Manowar. The horse proceeded to run the legs off everything that came near him. To some observers, the only sour note in Manowar's career was Riddle himself. In their view, the man had campaigned his horse too conservatively. When racing officials offered a fantastic pot of $50,000 for Riddle to pit his colt against Exterminator, the only horse who might have made Manowar work for his winnings, Riddle declined. He held his horse out of the Kentucky Derby, in part because of a disdain for Western tracks, and in part because he felt that early May was too soon to send a horse over a grueling mile and a quarter. In 1920, Riddle retired the colt at only 3 years of age. Manowar had run just 21 races, winning 20, and faced only 48 opponents. Riddle did not want to subject the horse to the extremely high imposts he was slated to carry. Manowar had made Riddle world famous, but the owner disliked the press as much as Charles Howard loved it. Some of the newsroom boys returned Riddle's animosity, but the fact that he owned some of the fastest and most noteworthy horses on earth led to a certain uneasy détente. The owner didn't help things when he stood up before a throng of people, reporters included, and told them that when it came to horses, the press knew just two things. One end bites, and the other end kicks. Manowar became a franchise of sorts for his owner, producing a long string of gifted runners whose winner's circle visits made Riddle one of the most photographed men in sport. but while many of Man-O-War's get were the best of their generations, none compared to their sire. Then, in the spring of 1934, horsemen started gathering by a fence at Riddle's breeding farm, gazing into a paddock and making the kind of awed noises that people make when a flaming meteor plunges out of the heavens and plows into someone's backyard. A regally bred mare named Brush-Up had foaled a near-black colt, a son of Man-O-War, and they couldn't take their eyes off of him. It was just the look of him. Even at a standstill, he was a glittering thing. He was the picture of exquisite, streamlined elegance, light and fine and quick. He moved like a bird, flickering, darting, fluttering. The horsemen gaped. Someone mused that when this one was done with racing, no one would remember Man-O-War. It was a kind of statement horsemen usually snort at, but no one who looked in at this colt was laughing. The foal grew up, and Riddle named him War Admiral. He had the same imperious, lordly way of his father. He would not tolerate stillness. He was so keyed to go that if a paddock official rang the saddling bell, he would lunge from his stall and drag his handlers toward the track. Once at the gate, he spun and fought, tossed the starters aside, lunged through false starts. But then the starter would set the field off. War Admiral would drop down and skim over the track, and everyone would forgive him for his imperiousness. Function followed form. War Admiral had awesome, frightening speed. Once underway, he was too fast for his rivals, too fast even for strategy. He dashed his opponents against their limitations the instant they left the starting gate, leaving them to ebb out like spilling water behind him. In the spring of 1937, he displayed such overwhelming acceleration and stamina that he was never off the lead at any stage of any race. No horse could touch him. After War Admiral, fuming and frustrated, held up the start for 8 minutes, victory in the Kentucky Derby came easily to him. The Preakness followed. The Belmont, the final conquest of the Triple Crown, set his name in stone. He repeatedly crashed through the gate, delaying the start for nearly 9 minutes. When, for one brief second, the colt was motionless, the starter hit the bell. War Admiral burst out with such power that his hindquarters overran his forequarters. He couldn't get his front hooves out of the way in time, and the toe of his hind shoe gouged into his right forehoof. He reared upward, yanking his hoof free. In doing so, he sheared off an inch-square hunk of his forehoof, leaving it lying on the track by the gate. His jockey, Charlie Kurtzinger, had no idea what had happened. War Admiral gave no indication. He lunged forward on the bleeding leg, blew past the entire field in 10 leaps, and charged on, a lurid spray of blood flying out behind him as he ran. No one could catch him. He took the victory, the Triple Crown, his father's track record, and an American speed record. When Kurtzinger slid off in the winner's circle and reached down to unlatch the girth, he was horrified to discover his colt's belly and hoof dripping with blood. The onlookers shivered. Tom Smith and Red Pollard, just in from the west with Seabiscuit, were in the Belmont stands to see War Admiral's epic performance. Smith knew the immense import of what he was seeing. He returned to Seabiscuit's barn at Aqueduct Racecourse that night and penned a letter to Charles Howard. "Saw War Admiral," Tom wrote. "He can really run." Samuel Riddle held Lightning in his hands again. By the summer of 1937, as War Admiral sat on the sidelines waiting for his hoof to grow back, it was clear that nothing in his age group could stay with him. War Admiral, like Man-O-War, awaited a horse who would take the true measure of his greatness. It never would have occurred to anyone in the East that this horse would be Seabiscuit. When they had last seen him, he was a mid-level stakes winner in the hands of a trainer no one had heard of and a jockey no one remembered. The horse had spent most of his career in the claiming or cheap allowance ranks, and the most accomplished trainer in America had given up on him. His winter victories said little of his quality, as they had been achieved on the suspect terrain of the West. On the morning of June 26, 1937, The day Seabiscuit was to begin his assault on the East's prestigious races by running in the Brooklyn Handicap. A New York columnist summed up Eastern opinion of him with two words, glorified plater. A record crowd of 20,000 jammed in to see Seabiscuit meet Rosemont and local hero Aneroid in the Brooklyn. As Seabiscuit came to the paddock, Smith looked over the mass of noisy humanity and frowned. He called over to Seabiscuit's exercise rider, Keith Stuckey, and asked him to position Pumpkin between Seabiscuit and the fans. Stuckey did as asked, and Pumpkin's enormous frame sidled over to create an artificial paddock wall. Smith saddled the horse in peace and sent him off. At the bell, Seabiscuit shot straight to the front and set a blistering pace around the first turn and down the backstretch. As the far turn neared, Rosemont began to roll toward him, and the crowd shouted its approval. Entering the far turn, Rosemont caught him, and for a moment they ran together. After a few strides, Rosemont faltered. Seabiscuit bounded away, but the race wasn't won yet. From the outside came Aneroid, swooping around the turn. He collared Seabiscuit with a quarter mile to go. Neither horse would give. Seabiscuit and Aneroid matched strides down the home stretch, with Aneroid whittling away at Seabiscuit's lead, inch by inch. With a furlong to go, Aneroid's head bobbed in front, just as Rosemont's had done a few months before. Through the reins, Pollard felt Seabiscuit's mouth harden down on the bit. Resolution. With a second to go, Seabiscuit burst ahead and thrust his nose over the line. The wreckage of the field was strewn out behind them. Rosemont was among them, 10 lengths back. Pollard cantered Seabiscuit back to the grandstand, posed for the win photos, then slid the saddle off and handed the horse to Stuckey, who was up on Pumpkin. Smith asked Stuckey to take Seabiscuit back to the barns, keeping him at a trot the whole way. Stuckey led the horse past the shouting fans and up through the shed rows. The cheering died out, and they were alone, trotting past row after row of barns. They drew near the Fitzsimmons barn, Seabiscuit's old home. A silent procession of stable hands came out and solemnly gazed at the horse they had let slip away. Regret was evident on every face. Stuckey said nothing and kept going. In New York, the trees swayed. Seabiscuit's eastern critics were, in the words of Jolly Roger, numbed to quietude. Their respect was grudging. Back in California, they had known it all along. The Western Union office in San Francisco was overwhelmed with hundreds of congratulatory telegrams for the Howards, including those from Bing Crosby, Al Jolson, and Fred Astaire. The papers were full of Seabiscuit, proclaimed on that coast to be the best horse in America. Back east, they weren't ready to grant him that much. The Easterners believed they still had one horse that could whip the Howards' plater. Around the backstretch, the murmurs began. "A single steed rests between him and the full championship," continued Jolly Roger. "War Admiral." July arrived, and on Seabiscuit went, back to Empire City, where he won the mile and 3/16 Butler handicap while conceding between 7 and 22 pounds to the rest of the field. 2 weeks later, he humiliated his opponents down in the Yonkers handicap under a staggering 129 pounds, breaking a mile and 1/16 track record that had stood for 23 years. In August, Seabiscuit went to Suffolk Downs to run in the prestigious Massachusetts handicap. There, he hooked up in a murderous head-to-head duel with a filly named Fair Nitus, who was carrying 108 pounds to Seabiscuit's 130. Screaming around the track side by side, she and Seabiscuit disposed of Aneroid, then left the field far behind. Deep in the home stretch, Fair Nitus finally began to weaken. Seabiscuit shook loose to win, clipping 0.25 seconds off the track record. Fair Nitus finished just 2 lengths behind him, fighting to the last. Seabiscuit cantered back to wild applause. Pollard leapt from his back and ran up the jockey's room stairs, shouting, "Hail the conquering hero comes! Well, boys, I finally got my picture took." The festivities moved from the track to the New England Turf Riders Association's annual dinner. Howard received a trophy, then Pollard came up to the stage to receive a commemorative whip. "I'll raise high and hit hard with it," he quipped. The audience, anesthetized by highballs, made no response. Pollard started clapping loudly, and the crowd looked up. "Hell," he shouted, "let's have some applause in this place." The Howards couldn't stop thinking about Fahrenheitis's dazzling performance. Sometime after the dinner, Howard contacted the Phillies' owner and offered an exorbitant sum for her. Shortly after, Fahrenheitis was led over to the Howard barn and moved into a stall down the row from Seabiscuit. She proved to be one of the few horses who could keep up with Seabiscuit in morning workouts, and unlike the colts, she didn't get demoralized when he taunted her, giving it right back to him. When Fahrenheitis's racing days were over, Howard wanted to breed her to Seabiscuit. A single thought occupied the minds of everyone in racing. Seabiscuit and War Admiral had to meet. Seabiscuit had beaten everything else the East had to offer. What's more, a heated, money-earning race had developed. Seabiscuit's 1937 earnings were now $142,030, about $2,000 behind War Admiral, who was the leading money winner for the season. Both horses were chasing the all-time career mark of $376,744, set by Sunbow in 1931. War Admiral's hoof had grown back, and he was back in training. All of the sport began talking of a match race. Even Bing Crosby, owner of a promising colt named High Strike, began goading Howard. "Congratulations," he wrote in a telegram to Howard after the Massachusetts handicap. "Pacific Coast clamoring for match race. High Strike, War Admiral, Seabiscuit, in that order." Howard loved the idea. Across the country, turf riders began agitating for the match. The Los Angeles Daily News began a running poll on who would win. Seabiscuit held a slight edge. Racetracks all over the nation began bidding for the race. Down in Florida, Hialeah officials began talking of $100,000 for a match on George Washington's birthday. Arlington Park in Chicago also bandied around the idea. Then, in late August, Bay Meadows wired a formal proposal to Howard and Samuel Riddle, offering $40,000 for a fall match, with Seabiscuit weighted at 126 pounds to 120 for the year younger War Admiral. Howard accepted. Riddle would not commit. The match race idea withered on the vine. Then Riddle surprised everyone. After strong urging from Santa Anita founder Doc Strube, he agreed to enter War Admiral in the 1938 100 grander, Seabiscuit's career objective. The press jumped on it. Smith was skeptical. He knew enough about Riddle to believe that the old owner would never subject his skittish colt to a 5-day rail journey to race in what he viewed as the sport's minor leagues. Smith believed they were going to have to hunt War Admiral on his own turf. Seabiscuit had won 7 consecutive stakes races. The all-time record was 8. Howard wanted to break the record, but he had a tough choice to make. As Smith had foreseen, since his stellar performance in the 1937 Santa Anita handicap, Seabiscuit had been assigned the highest weight in virtually every race, at times carrying over 20 pounds more than his rivals. By the rule of thumb that every 2 to 3 pounds slows a horse by a length at 8 to 10 furlongs, a mile to a mile and a quarter, and every pound costs him a length at 10 furlongs or more, Seabiscuit was running with massive handicaps. The higher the impost, the greater the risk of injury, a significant concern for Seabiscuit, who had a history of leg trouble. Many top horses before him, such as his grandsire, Man of War, had been retired prematurely to avoid high imposts. Others who had continued to campaign under high weight, such as Equipoise and Discovery, had lost repeatedly. Howard was willing to accept higher weight to a point. "Seabiscuit," he said, "is not a truck." He set a limit of 130 pounds, choosing that weight because it was the most the racing secretary would be permitted to assign in the 1938 Santa Anita handicap. Should Seabiscuit win that event, Howard stated, he would be willing to accept higher imposts. 130 was an enormous impost. Many of history's greatest horses had failed to win under it. But Howard's statement was not well received. Several columnists accused him of lacking the courage